A communications disruption can mean only one thing: invasion.
A communication disruption can only mean one thing:
negotiation. We've lost all communications.
Invasion. What will the future of Star Wars bring?
You must contact me.
You must contact me and listen to Reed.
They wouldn't dare.
It's unthinkable.
In this sea of bibbles, babble, bubble, Star Wars prequels appreciation podcast.
It's outrageous.
Hello, and welcome to CO Bibbles Babble Bubble, your one pod racer pit stop for all things Star Wars prequels appreciation. As longtime fans of the show will know, I spend a lot of time focusing on not just the prequels, but the period in which they were released. So we're talking 1999 through 2005, and I look at things that were happening in that era. So last episode, I was looking at the show Survivor and putting a Star Wars twist on it. Or, you know, we've looked at how can we see the NBA in that period and make a Star Wars lens to it. So on and so forth. So I operate around at this turn of the millennium. But I wanted to do something different. And I wanted to look at the period after the prequels up until the time of the Disney purchase. So this is when Disney buys Lucasfilm and starts to make their own media, the new wave of Disney, the sequel trilogy, the new animated shows, so on and so forth. So we're looking at effectively roughly a 10-year period here, from 2005, when Revenge of the Sith came out, to 2015, when The Force Awakens was released. And in that period, yes, there were inklings of Star Wars, but on a main level, on a grand scheme of things, this was a dark ages of sorts for Star Wars content. You know, nothing was really hitting the theaters, with the exception of the animated Clone Wars movie in 2008. And there was no new material for us to digest outside of the books, and some comics, and a few video game types things. But Star Wars had moved out of the main, you know, cultural psyche. Zeitgeist, I should say. And so I wanted to look at my own personal experience. You know, what was it like as someone who, as a kid, grew up with the prequels, but then entered my teenage years without having Star Wars on the forefront? You know, what were the franchises that filled that particular void? So, 2005, I was 11 years old, and I don't see The Force Awakens until I'm 21. So those are very important formative years for me and for members of my generation who went through middle school, high school, and most of college without any new Star Wars on the big screen. So what I'm going to do here, this is going to be a two-part episode where I'm going to break down the years that we're looking at here, break down the Dark Age years, and talk about what were the big pieces of media that were important to me. Now, if you're listening to this, you'll say, oh, you know, in 2009, there was a you know, I don't know when the Hunger Games novels came out, but sometime around there, or Twilight, you know, that didn't resonate with me at the time, so they're not going to get a mention. This very much has a personal focus, so I'm not necessarily saying that this is the best stuff objectively that came out during this period, but this is the stuff that filled the Star Wars sized void for me. I'm going to go through each year, pointing out the medium, maybe say what's some of my favorite, and doing a little bit of breakdown as well. So here we are, diving into the Dark Ages. So I want to set the stage of what, you know, what are the franchises that filled that hole for me. So we're talking about Harry Potter, both the films and the books, the television series Battlestar Galactica, the Mass Effect video game franchise, Game of Thrones and the books A Song of Ice and Fire, the Dark Knight trilogy, the rise of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, so that's Phase 1 and Phase 2, as well as some Marvel comic lines, some crossover events. that came out around the same time. Now, all of these contributed to my growing up in a way that Star Wars did, in the sense that I learned a lot of life lessons. It opened doors into science fiction and fantasy that were completely novel to me, taught me ways to perceive storytelling and creativity and world building, and just opening something that as a teenager through young adulthood sort of gave me the tools to be, you know, a successful independent thinker outside of, you know, the traditional schooling and, you know, reading high class literature, so to say, you know, and watching, you know, the Academy Award winning type movies like Slumdog Millionaires in the middle of this period, or The Departed, so on and so forth. So, you know, these are things that I would put in the same genre of Star Wars, in the sense, if you want to say Star Wars is the merger of science fiction and fantasy, then let's lump that all together. You know, what makes the prequels era so unique is that, in addition to it housing the release of the Star Wars prequels, you also had the Lord of the Rings franchise come out around the same time. So it's two really big, really pivotal ones, and there is an open hole that felt the need to be filled after that. And then, of course, you see the Tobey Maguire Spider-Man come out roughly around the same time of the prequels eras, as well as the Hugh Jackman, the original X-Men trilogy that we see there. But there's a bit of overlap, and those were all very important to me. Oh, the Matrix films, of course, came out during the same time as well. But, you know, all that stuff was kind of a foundational basis. And, you know, one thing that I think is key, you know, when I'm naming stuff like Lord of the Rings and the Matrix and whatnot, you know, I did not see all of those in theaters. That's a lot of stuff that either I was too young, like too scared, or I just wasn't interested in that at the time. So, you know, I saw, of course, all the Star Wars films as they came out, and then, you know, later Lord of the Rings films as they came out. But, you know, a lot of that, for the prequels era, I wasn't living in that in the live moment, you know. So I didn't see The Matrix until well after it came out. So it's not necessarily as influential. But, you know, this swath of media here in 2005 to 2015, this is stuff that I ingested as it was being released, as it was coming out. It was fresh, and I had, you know, midnight viewings, getting the books the day of, discussing it, you know, what's coming next, so on and so forth. So that was all really exciting. So let's dive in. We'll start with 2005, because even though Revenge of the Sith came out in 2005, and I use that kind of as the closed parentheses when talking about the prequels era, not just, you know, the film coming out in May, but December, I go ahead and wrap everything in there. I think we need to start there, because that's when you have the degree of phasing into this new particular era. And so, in 2005, we have the second-to-last Harry Potter book gets released. And this is Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince. And this was a huge piece of culture right here, because it had kind of the ultimate spoiler, at least for people of my generation. So as a reminder, like I said, I was 11 at this point. And that is that Snape kills Dumbledore, and that was something that you could be in on. And what we know about Harry Potter, you know, when you see the Half-Blood Prince book come out, and that year, The Goblet of Fire, that film came out, is that, you know, for young people of my generation, we were growing up with them. You know, we were growing at the same age as the characters, roughly, you know? Like, to the point that, you know, it didn't line up perfectly all the time, but that, you know, a movie would come out and they were at the same grade level that I would have been in at school. So that was kind of fun and exciting, because that was more relatable than saying, okay, you know, here's Anakin Skywalker, who's, what, 23, 24? Here's Padme, you know, who's 27. You know, that's still adult. That's out of our reach. You know, we're looking up to them rather than looking next to them like we did with Harry and Ron and Hermione and the Weasley twins and Draco Malfoy and all of the wonderful characters there. I know that the Harry Potter franchise has received a lot of flack recently, and rightfully so, because of, you know, J.K. Rowling, the author, and the creating of what's now known as the wizarding world of J.K. Rowling, because of additional media, you know, has come up with some pretty strong anti-trans opinions, and she's rightly being criticized for that, and hopefully that's a learning experience for a lot of people. But nevertheless, I don't want to take away what that franchise meant to me as it came out. You know, 2005 was a really good year because I loved Revenge of the Sith, and just a few months later, you know, Goblet of Fire comes out, and that for me was a really fun film. I know a lot of people kind of look at it weird that, you know, they see that Prisoner of Azkaban came out in 2004, the year prior. It was wildly successful, very popular for offering a dark and gritty take, and, you know, Goblet of Fire didn't quite hit the same stride. You don't have the same directorial talent behind it. It still was fun because it expanded the world of Harry Potter, in the sense we got to see the wizarding community better with the World Cup, and we got to meet new characters, and we got to see, you know, what a full-fledged Voldemort looks like, and the Death Eaters and character designs. And so that was really filling in some of the flavorings that Star Wars led us thirsting for, that we were hungry for. You know, because Star Wars is very fast. But, you know, in the first three Harry Potter movies, it's a little more closed in. I mean, you get to see a lot. You know, you get to see, you know, Hogsmeade, and they go to the Shrieking Shack and Diagon Alley and all that jazz. And you get to familiarize yourself with different characters. But you don't really start to get to grasp with just how large the world is, that it has the capacity to kind of compete with Star Wars. Obviously, nothing can compete with the sheer size of Star Wars, with the exception of, you know, if you go into the fullness of Tolkien's legendarium of Lord of the Rings, and that's a different story altogether. But, you know, Harry Potter was showing that, look, we can offer you this diversity in costumes, this diversity in character design, and you get to experience that all. Just like the book, A Half-Blood Prince gave us the option, you had to read it, the section if you were reading it, the opportunity to see the wizarding world interact with the muggling world, because that's the moment in which the Prime Minister of Britain gets to meet the Minister of Magic in a delightful conversation there, and a good catch-up. So I think Harry Potter really picked up stride, and it didn't, you know, it didn't leave much hanging in terms of, like, there wasn't too big of a gap before something really big and significant showed up. Because we're looking at, you know, like a November-ish release for that compared to a May release. So it's not even a full, that's about half a year. That's 6 months between Star Wars. It worked well for me because I actually moved back to Texas from New Jersey weeks after Revenge of the Sith came out. And so, you know, that was kind of closing a chapter for me, and I was able to move on to it. And there was kind of the more grown-up version of the Harry Potter franchise there waiting to embrace me, and I accepted it fully, never pushing Star Wars aside, mind you. No. I, you know, held on to it very, very fully. The last Star Wars Lego set I got for a long time, though, was in that year. I believe it was 2005, may have been in 2006, when you had I think it was the droid, it was the droid ship being attacked by Wookiees in the Battle of Kashyyyk. And then I didn't get Star Wars Legos for a long time, nor any really Harry Potter ones. It's funny how this all lined up in a new chapter for my life in more ways than one. So also in 2005, we get the second season of Battlestar Galactica. Now, Battlestar Galactica had premiered the year before in 2004. And, you know, I'll admit, I did not jump into the show right away, so I can't say that unlike the Harry Potter stuff, this is not stuff I watched live. But I was aware of it, and I was just a little bit behind the curve. And it was really cool to see a more realistic science fiction, you know, one that was more grounded. Because as I often discuss on this show, and as many people often say, Star Wars is definitely a fantasy in space, a space opera, less so than a science fiction. And so it was cool to see, you know, Battlestar Galactica touch upon, you know, these science fiction-y, you know, themes, that everything's more grounded in a degree of realism. You know, they don't shoot lasers, they're shooting legit, you know, rounds of ammo in their space battles. And the ship designs are cool. obviously a wonderfully acted show, you know, beautifully performed, where we get to see, you know, for instance, Katie Sackhoff playing Starbuck. Katie, of course, who is now since been in the Star Wars franchise as Bo-Katan, most recently seeing her in live action at the Mandalorian show, which is very, you know, it meant a lot to people such as myself who got to see her as Starbuck in Battlestar Galactica, to see that BSG filled in a gap that Star Wars left, and to see that somebody who helped make that gap more comfortable come back to Star Wars is like you coming back to Star Wars. It's a very warming feeling. And so, you know, I really think a lot needs to be celebrated there, and the fact that the timing of Battlestar Galactica, you know, cannot be understated in terms of its significance. Now, also in that year, we see Batman Begins, which is, you know, it's interesting because, as you know, outside of the X-Men movies and Tobey Maguire's Spider-Man, which was starting to create the, well, here you have a franchise of movies, you know, but nothing's really super tied together, and you're still used to, well, let's have standalone superhero movies. We've been used to, like, okay, there's multiple Batman movies, but it's a different guy playing Batman each time. Or Superman movies. It's a different guy playing Superman after, you know, Christopher Reeve. And so that's what you're expecting going into Batman Begins, that, okay, this is kind of a Batman origin story. And obviously it introduced this whole idea that let's make superhero films gritty. Let's make them realistic. And, you know, I don't think anyone at the time could have predicted the sheer, oh, I don't know, the sheer just significance that this was going to kick off. You know, that Christopher Nolan was going to start, that he defined what generation of people demand superhero films should look like. You know, that's the superhero film that they want. Now, I wasn't necessarily part of that camp, but I thought it was super cool at the time. Plus, you know, once again, tying it to Star Wars, we got to see Liam Neeson, who, you know, a lot of people had, in my age at least, you know, had only known him or primarily known him as Qui-Gon Jinn, as a mentor who is in the first act of a trilogy. So here we're seeing him fulfill that role here as Ra's al Ghul mentoring Batman. So that was very familiar, but it felt more grown up. So it felt like this is the movie that we who as kids liked The Phantom Menace and Attack of the Clones and Revenge of the Sith. This is the movie that's preparing us for what adult films are supposed to be and supposed to look like. The remaining two releases, the 2005 releases I want to mention here, before going forward, this is when we're getting into printed materials, because I think it's very important to note. So we see the release of the House of M crossovers event, the comics. So this is a very influential comic book series, at which point, long story short, it's an alternate reality in the Marvel comic universe in which the mutants are in the control of society rather than being the downtrodden, and introduced, at least to me, you know, all these Marvel characters, because I had grown up, you know, in the prequels era and beforehand watching the DC animated universe with, you know, Batman the Animated Series, Batman Begins, Justice League Unlimited, Static Shock. I was not familiar with Marvel. And this is the first comic line that I read where I really got to be introduced to some of these characters. Now, granted, this is an alternate reality version of it, so it's very different than the ones we get to see. You know, Captain America doesn't play that big of a role in it, because in this reality, he's an old man who, you know, is a war vet. It's kind of neat, though, because this is kind of like the Captain America we do see at the end of Endgame. So that's kind of a nice little reference. I don't know if they'll play that up further. But it showed me that, oh, comics can be cool, superheroes can be cool outside of just of what we know of the X-Men. The other book, or published material, I should say, that came out in 2005 is A Feast for Crows from A Song of Ice and Fire. Now, I have this on my list italicized because I want it to be known, you know, I did not read this book until well after it came out. I was one of those people who saw the first season of Game of Thrones, went back, and then discovered the existence of the book franchise and read all of those. Nevertheless, I think it's warranted to say that it did come out in 2005. And, you know, I'm sure just as a lot of these shows like Battlestar Galactica or the Harry Potter books and films, you know, filled in a hole that Star Wars left behind, I think Game of Thrones and A Song of Ice and Fire was doing that for other people at this stage. I mean, obviously it gets a lot bigger when the series comes out, but at least for the book, you know, that probably was a lot of publication release going on about it and a lot of hot buzz and stuff that drew people in. I think it was I was a little too young at the time to be into it, being at 11, you know, the big books coming out at that age, you know, that year. I don't have the dates in front of me, but think about like the Aragorn novels with the dragons. That was kind of hot. Or, you know, I think Percy Jackson, the Olympians, maybe a tad bit later, but stuff like that. And then, like I said earlier, Twilight comes a few years before we kind of grow into, oh, let's read books with, you know, incestuous knights and medieval-esque families. So it's a little, you know, out of the comfort zone. I was reading The Guardians of Ga'Hoole at the time. If you don't recall, that's the one with the owls who fight each other. They made a movie about it. They animated a movie that was pretty so-so, but nonetheless, it was a worthwhile and enjoyable thing, but not worthwhile and enjoyable enough to warrant getting on this list. So that's 2005, which is one of the more populated years on this list. Anyhow, after that we have 2006. This is kind of weak compared to the grand scheme of things here, where you have Battlestar Galactica still going on. Season 3 premieres. Season 3 has probably the single greatest arc of episodes to open any season out there. It's fantastic. Unfortunately, the show kind of starts to drop down a bit after the new Caprica storyline. For those of you familiar with it, that's when they settle on a planet and Gaius Baltar is the president. He's propped up by Cylons and sort of a slave state going on there. And it's all all sorts of tricky, but, you know, I think season 3 is great. Season 2 and 3 are my favorite seasons of the show, so that's why it's nice it's happening in 2005 and 2006. And then the other thing I want to mention is the, you know, Marvel Civil War comic crossover event comes out. Now, this is the one that really got me into Marvel comics. I think House of M is better written in a more interesting storyline, but Civil War is when you start to really be introduced to some of these characters who have gotten to know well on the screen, because it's a battle between Tony Stark and Captain America. And of course, we see the storyline very, 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 very loosely adapted in the movie Captain America Civil War, which comes out, you know, near over a decade later, I think. No, actually, exactly a decade later. That came out in 2016. But nonetheless, it got me to really know the cast of characters, you know, who are the various heroes and villains of Marvel, and it laid the seeds, the groundwork, for me to be really excited for what was coming. You know, what did I have to look forward to once I started to know these Marvel films were coming out at the time? So, you know, 2006, though, a relative weak year compared to what we had just seen in 2005. So 2007, a little bit, you know, exciting. We get the final Harry Potter book is published with the Deathly Hallows published out then. You know, I think I personally enjoyed Half-Blood Prince a bit more, but, you know, it was fun to see and bittersweet to see that movie series come to, pardon me, that book series come to a conclusion. Order of the Phoenix comes out as a film, and I would probably say that's my least favorite of the Harry Potter films. If you were to ask me right now, excluding all the various Fantastic Beast ones, like Crimes of Grindelwald. Nonetheless, you know, it was exciting to see that. It was strange to see Harry go from the long, what I would call Corona lockdown hair, because he and I have the same hair length right now, to, you know, something more shortcut. And, you know, I just don't think they executed it well, because Order of the Phoenix was one of my favorite books, and so I had very high expectations. But the performances of Dolores Umbridge playing a truly despicable villain, you know, I really have to salute there. The big positive, though, in 2007 for me, the thing that really rocked my world that I was not expecting whatsoever, was the release of Mass Effect on the Xbox 360. 2007, a huge year for Xbox. As we see, that's also the release of Halo 3, which, you know, was the highest selling video game, at least on Xbox systems, for a good while, set in that year. Mass Effect was the one that more rocked my style. So it was written by Drew Karpyshyn, who's the guy who wrote Star Wars Knights of the Old Republic, beloved BioWare video game. It was excellent to see here is a game that has the BioWare mechanic that I'm familiar with, having played the Knights of the Old Republic games. But when you click the dialogue options, your character literally says it out loud. And it felt very immersive and very cool. Mass Effect has a unique history with the Star Wars universe because BioWare was asked by LucasArts, or LucasFilms, I suppose, the Lucas people, to say, we need you to make a game, or we'd like for you to make a game in tandem with the Phantom Menace, you know, and the prequels coming up. You know, that was this initial conversation. Eventually, you know, it was after Attack of the Clones we finally get to see this game, where they say you could either make an RPG that takes place in tandem with the Phantom Menace storyline, or thousands of years beforehand. And so that's how we got Knights of the Old Republic. They went with the latter of the two options. And so a lot of the same team, like I said, Drew Karpyshyn, and other writers and developers who are big Star Wars fans, wanted to take that out and put it in a kind of an independent franchise. And that was how Mass Effect spun out, where they said, let's take everything we love about science fiction and, you know, Star Wars, and put it with space travel in our own galaxy. And so they, instead of the Force, they come up with a more scientific explanation about people who are adepts and who can control biotics. And, you know, it's a truly beautiful franchise, in my opinion. Very immersive. You make decisions that you feel like matter. Even the small ones, you feel like they matter to the characters. And you get to build teams and relationships with the people on your teams. They're all, you know, non-playable characters. I mean, it's not online play, at least at this point. And, you know, I get very emotional thinking about what this franchise meant for me, because at this point, you know, I was 13 years old. You get to enter that age where, you know, you're the teenager getting bullied a bit in school, or, you know, aware of various uncomfortable things. And so that was an escape for me. And I would say, you know, someone who loves Star Wars as much as I do, Mass Effect stepped in and replaced Star Wars as my number one, you know, at least for a time being. You know, Harry Potter was definitely a Band-Aid of sorts. But, you know, Mass Effect was a full-on, you know, step aside Star Wars, we're going to replace you as a main focus. Now, of course, that since has swapped back to the way it was, but like I said, it was at the right place in the right time for me. I feel like this is the type of franchise that I could get behind. This is something that I'm also seeing birthed from the ground up. You know, I obviously love the prequels and I love Star Wars, but, you know, I was not around when the original trilogy was first released, so it wasn't something fresh. This was a continuation of an existing thing. The prequels, I mean. You know, Mass Effect, it was something brand new. I felt like I'm at ground zero of being a fan of something. And, you know, knowing that, you know, Garrus Vakarian will always be my favorite character in science fiction, just in terms of a wonderful companion you can have in the game. And, you know, he's sort of like a cross of Chewbacca meets Han Solo, all rolled in one. You know, and that's just beyond cool and beyond fun. And I still play that game all the time, the first one, and all the spinoffs too. The main character is a member of the N7 program, and I have an N7 patch on one of my shirts. I've got another patch referencing the franchise on another shirt. You know, so I'm very much diehard and committed. Beautifully voice acted too. It looks great, and the remastered version of the game is coming out, so that is extraordinarily exciting. I am chomping at the bit to get to work on that, to really see, let me take this beautiful story and see it on, you know, the next generation of graphics processors and seeing it smoothed out like that. And the gameplay is nice, too. You know, the first-person shooter was really stepping up in here. You know, at this point, we're about at the time when Call of Duty Modern Warfare first comes out, and we get to see all the eventual Call of Duty spinoffs of that. And like I said earlier, Halo 3 was big, and first-person shooting was never my thing as much as it was for some of my peers. So I wouldn't necessarily say, you know, I vibed with the FPS stuff. But to see here's a third-person shooter that feels as immersive as a first-person shooter, where you really feel associated with the character, not some kind of strange bird's-eye view like you'd see in the earlier Fallout games, or even, you know, let's pause to tell people what moves to do in Knights of the Old Republic, you really felt like you were in control. It was action, adventure, RPG, design your own characters, what outfits they wear, what guns they're carrying, what space power moves they want to do if you're an adept, which, of course, anybody who is a Star Wars fan, I imagine, would have to want to be an adept or a sentinel or a tech, at which rate, or a vanguard, at which rate you have either these biotic powers or tech powers, because that's the closest thing you have to force powers, you know, out there that you're fully experiencing. You get to feel like, oh, I'm like a Jedi, but with a gun. Like, that's cool. Who doesn't want to try that out, you know? Anyhow, that's why 2007 is very important to me, because it gave that game. There's a great book that came out at the same time, too. Mass Effect Revelation, also written by Drew Karpyshyn, so it didn't feel like a spinoff. It felt like a legit continuation of the game. So anyhow, this gets us to 2008. 2008 is a lot like 2005 in the sense that we have a lot of stuff that comes out, some very big moments. So this is the final season of Battlestar Galactica, premieres at 2008. There's another Mass Effect book that's released, Mass Effect Ascension, so it's continuing the love that I'm feeling for that particular franchise onward. But what's key here is you have the introduction of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. So, you know, as I said, I've now been sitting at this point for 3 years getting to know the Marvel characters in House of M, in Marvel Civil War, and reading other things. You know, smaller comics that were coming on, Wolverine, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., some older Elektra stuff, getting to know the X-Men outside of just the films. But now we get to see Marvel films on the big screen. And this is the release of Iron Man, directed by Jon Favreau, bringing us the wonderful and truly fantastic performance of Robert Downey Jr. as Tony Stark. Where we get to see an origin film. And it also showed us that an origin film can be good and lighthearted without having to be a Batman Begins type thing. You know, as everyone was calling gritty, 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 you know, Iron Man offered something a little more lighthearted while talking on some very key and important themes. You know, they modernized Iron Man's origin. They put him as, you know, they kept the whole arms dealer thing, but he was an arms dealer who was, you know, selling into supporting wars in the Middle East, so that made it very topical. You know, at the 2008, the time that the film came out, we were 9 years removed from 9/11, but we were still very much, the United States is what I say by we, engaged in Afghanistan and Iraq, and war fatigue is very much felt. The conversation of withdrawal of troops is a major point in the political conversation as Barack Obama is running for president against John McCain, you know, promising to decrease the troop presence or find a peaceful resolution in the Middle East. And so it made a ton of sense to take that storyline and put it there. You know, as I'm talking about Iron Man bringing in modern themes, this makes me want to go back to Battlestar Galactica really quickly. That, you know, one thing that made Battlestar Galactica so appealing is that so much in science fiction was very Cold War influenced leading up to that point where, you know, oh, let's do dystopian futures that have hints of anti-Soviet states or, you know, autocracies and cyberpunk that sound like, you know, what if the Soviets had won but not that explicitly stated, or very 20th century, let's think of, you know, Nazis and, you know, McCarthyism rolled into science fiction, and that you see that a lot. But Battlestar Galactica brought in at then modern influences. So the role of terrorism, not knowing what the enemy looks like by the Cylons looking like people, that's what Battlestar Galactica did, and that really defined the feelings and what were the main driving points in the, you know, the global space at the time. So that was really cool, and that's what Iron Man's doing here, bringing it all back around. How, you know, they're making the Middle East a you know, a major plot point and subject area at which we can launch into the entirety of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. It also showed we could get big names into these superhero films, right? I mean, it's not that there weren't big names and stuff leading up to it. You know, Patrick Stewart at this point had been playing Professor Xavier in the X-Men films for 8 years and doing a great job, you know, great Shakespearean actor. But, you know, here we saw, whatchamacallit, Jeff Bridges playing Obadiah Stone. You know, this is a guy who had not yet won his Oscar, but everyone thought had been very much deserving of it, was knocking on the door of one all-time great performances, you know, multiple nominee, that it felt, okay, you're bringing in, you know, some pretty heavy talent into this. Now, of course, you know, Robert Downey Jr., we think of now as being big, but at the time that Iron Man came out, it was actually a redemption film from him, for him, because his career had taken an unfortunate turn of events, and he had made a series of bad choices and struggled with a lot of very dark things in his life, and so this is what brought him back out to life, and that's why you see him play Tony Stark so well, because a lot of what RDJ experienced was very similar to what Tony Stark, the character, went through. So it was excellent to see that brought to life. It should go that noting that The Incredible Hulk also came out that year, the second film of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. There's not much crossover, though, because at the time, that's Edward Norton who's playing Bruce Banner. You know, of course, we get to now love and know Mark Ruffalo in that role. And so it's a little bit, you know, a little bit different. And we see Betty Ross as a character who's never brought back. But we see her father, Thunderbolt Ross, you know, later in Marvel movies down the line. So it's, you know, it's part of the same thing. And, of course, you know, at this point, Paramount's releasing these films, and, you know, Disney's beginning to sniff around the acquisition and distribution of these Marvel movies, and so they're starting to get their toehold. And, of course, this is the blueprint that eventually Star Wars will follow. Maybe not as precisely, but as we've seen definitely with the releases of new shows on Disney Plus and new movies coming out, creating a connected universe like we're seeing at Marvel, Star Wars, it wouldn't have happened had they not had the Marvel run that's picking up in 2008. You know, even though all of these Marvel films are showing a more lighthearted, less gritty approach, the gritty movement is still going on strong in 2008, at which point we see The Dark Knight, which is critically considered the greatest of the Batman films. Some people say it's the greatest superhero film ever made, even to this date, 12 years after the fact, clamoring that it should be nominated for Best Picture. That's a major reason why the number of nominees went from 5 to at most 10. You know, we can have at least 5 to 10 instead of capping at 5, was because people felt The Dark Knight deserved to be included. You know, so it was fun to see that franchise expanding at that point and see, let's have quote-unquote good cinema mix with popular culture, going with something like Batman and seeing that merger there. So it's not just a standalone of, oh, Batman Begins is a hero origin story told differently besides, oh, let's watch Uncle Ben get shot in Spider-Man 1 with Tobey Maguire. You know, oh, it's taking a more artistic approach. And I use artistic very loosely. By no means am I saying, this is an art house film, it's beautifully done. You know, it's still a superhero film through and through. And so, anyhow, The Dark Knight, let's watch it continue. And, of course, we do see an Oscar for it. It, you know, wins an Oscar for Best Supporting Actor with the late, great Heath Ledger, who, you know, unfortunately, his own struggles led to his very early demise, departure from the planet. That sounded bad, but overdose. And so that Oscar was posthumously awarded to him. Should be noted, 2008 also saw the release of the Secret Invasion comic, which it's another crossover event with Marvel, you know, keeping that thread going. It introduced me to sort of Marvel as a space thing, not just stuff on planet. We see the Skrulls, not introduced to everybody. The Skrulls had been around before, but the Skrulls infiltrate American society in the globe, and it turns out a lot of these superheroes are also, you know, actually been aliens the whole time, and so that expands a lot of stuff. I don't think it's as good as House of M or Civil War, but I wanted to put it in there because it was a crossover line that I was reading at the time, and so I think it very much deserves to be thrown in here. As you can see, though, a lot of great stuff in 2008. The Clone Wars animated movie comes out in 2008, and the TV show starts off there, and I will be the first to admit, you know, very sadly, it did not vibe with me at the time. I'm so sorry. I know I talk about it a lot on this show. This is a Star Wars podcast, But you know, at this point, I'd gone 3 years without Star Wars content on the screen, and other stuff had started to fill my interest. Like I say, with Mass Effect, and you know, Harry Potter's still big, and superheroes are starting to show up a bit. And so, yeah, you know, I saw the movie, and I just didn't think it was that great. It's, of course, grown on me, absolutely, and the series has grown excellently on me. But I would like to say, you know, that the Clone Wars just didn't come out at the right time for me. And that's not a knock on it now. That's not a knock on it then. It's just where it was for me as somebody absorbing that type of media. So it kind of gets brushed over. Something to chew on. I apologize. They, you know, throwing that out there. Anyhow, so after that, in 2009... a light year, kind of similar to 2006. You sort of see, definitely between 2005 and 2010, a lot of, you know, valleys and troughs, valleys and peaks going on, where you have years with a lot and years with not so much. So in 2009, the main two events for me are the Half-Blood Prince film comes out, which I really enjoyed that movie. I think there was a lot of elements that resonated with me because it's kind of the biggest teen movie of that, and at that point I was 15. And so, you know, the characters at the point were 16, so they very much felt like peers, as I was alluding to early. And, you know, it was hard not to see stuff like, oh, you know, the Ron and Lavender Brown romance, and not feel like, oh, I know friends who are in situations like that, or, oh, I wish I was in a situation like that. Because, spoiler alert here, ladies and gentlemen, I wasn't really much of someone who dated in high school, so I kind of had a little bit of envy going on looking on the characters, even if Lavender Brown was a bit clingy. But nevertheless, you know, it was a good teen film, and I think just where I was in life, I really enjoyed it. And, you know, I still tell friends it's probably a top 4 Harry Potter movie for me, so that was fun. And then this is sort of where you see me tapering off a bit in terms of following the Marvel comic lines. Dark Reign, Dark Avengers comes out. So this is the point when basically, after all the crap you had seen in the Marvel line with House of M, Civil War, Secret Invasion, the heroes kind of get put into hiding and the villains get to take over. And that runs for like 4 years, up until 2013, where you get to see Norman Osborn, aka the Green Goblin, be Iron Patriot, a cross between Iron Man and Captain America. You get to see Wolverine's son pretend to be him. You get to see Venom be Spider-Man. And all sorts of stuff like that. And so I thought that was a cool role reversal, and I really do hope that the Dark Reign stuff gets adapted somehow or another in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, because we're starting to see little pickups around here and there, just as, you know, Civil War was partially adapted. Secret Invasion we may still fully get, because we saw a nice Skrulls movie with Captain Marvel, and then the Spider-Man Far From Home after-credit scene. And House of M, maybe that's a bit of what WandaVision's about. So it's cool. So maybe Dark Reign and the Dark Avengers will happen. Anyhow, this is going to be my halfway point. This is the end of part one. And so I'm releasing part ones and two very close to one another. So keep your eyes and ears open. I hope you've enjoyed this. And we're going to dive into 2010 through 2015 in the second episode. For usual, I will catch you all around the corner. Bubble, 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 bubble